Material.
Listening to the power hitter of FM radio. Keep it tuned to CKUT 90.3 FM.
I think the magnitude of this will probably not sink in or talked about or understood for a while.
CKUT.
Did you get vaccinated?
Not yet, but I will soon.
And which one are you getting?
I'm getting the dance vaccine.
The dance vaccine? Great idea.
Yeah, rehearsing with the girls is what I miss the most.
Well, it's going to be the soccer vaccine for me. I can't wait to see the gang again.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Spread your wings. One-stop Caribbean cuisine for the best in Caribbean dishes. Come visit us and enjoy our specialties such as oxtail, jerk chicken, roti, and many more. Ask about our $8 lunch special on any chicken plates from Tuesdays to Fridays, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Also try our famous crispy fried chicken dipped in our special barbecue sauce. You can order online through your preferred restaurant apps or call 514-365-3636 or enjoy a 10% discount on all in-store pickup. This don't apply to promotions. We are located at 334 Saint-Jacques in Lachine. Visit us today. One Stop Caribbean Cuisine. Chef X, new location.
Blessing up a flow like a river. Blessing up a flow like a river.
Can music give you what you need? Does sound have the power to process complex emotions? Can placebos help? How are you today?
I'm Erin.
And I'm Julia.
How are you
and
today?
We're here to offer a kind of help with Audio Placebo Plaza. For 1 week, we offer everyday people customized positive messages, audio creations, healing frequencies, binaural beads, ASMR, and more. From June 11th to 16th at 6835 Rue Saint-Hubert and on undefined.fm.
This project is produced by Undefined Radio and co-presented by Tony Pearl Popolo and CKUT.
Vision Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune into the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, and every second Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number, you weren't a man, you want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Jalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices from struggles for liberation from all around the world. Welcome.
June 11th is the International Day of Solidarity with Marius Mason and all long-term anarchist prisoners. This year, we want to explore the connections between long-term prisoner support and anti-repression efforts around the recent uprisings, a sharp reminder to us that the difference between the status of imprisoned or not is a tenuous and temporary one. With thousands of arrests for protesting, rioting, and property destruction from last summer's George Floyd uprising, we must be preparing for the possibility that more of our friends and other rebels may end up in prison. We're also seeking to find ways to facilitate interactions between our long-term prisoners and uprisings in the street. To this end, we speak with Cameron and Vera, who are a part of the group that have supported the prisoners from the Ferguson Uprising for the last 7 years, as well as Earthworm from Atlanta Solidarity and ATL Jail Support, and finally Jeremy Hammond, formerly incarcerated anarchist and hacktivist, and his brother Jason Hammond, who works with the Chicago Community Bond Fund. They produce a podcast called Twin Trouble that's in the Channel Zero Network. These folks share with us experiences with state repression, what motivates them, and some thoughts on what we can be doing to make us, our communities, and our liberatory movements more resilient. These speakers respond to questions in the same order throughout the conversations, but didn't always identify themselves, so remember that the order of and the listing of projects can be found in our show notes. You can learn more about Marius Mason and how to support him at supportmariusmason.org. You can also see past podcasts by June 11th, prisoner statements, artwork, info about prisoners supported by the effort, a mixtape they curated last year, and events listed for various cities that you can join in on at June 11 or June11.org. We'll link the call out in English in our show notes, but it's also in Spanish, German, French, and Dutch on the website, alongside a ton of other material for printing, distribution, and sharing. We're releasing this audio before June 11th to entice folks to consider a potluck, or an action, or a letter-writing event, or a banner drop, a postering rampage, or something else to share that day with folks behind the walls. You can also hear our past interviews from June 11th stretching back about a decade by looking at our website and just searching for that category or tag. If you're listening in Asheville, join Blue Ridge Anarchist Black Cross today, June 6th, for a letter writing event from 5 to 7 p.m. at West Asheville Park on Vermont Avenue. BRABC meets the first Sunday of every month at that time, provides info on prisoners with upcoming birthdays or who are facing repression, stationery, postage, and company. Have you never written a letter before? Don't know how to start? You can swing by and share some space. You can find out more about our project at brabc.blackblogs.org or follow us on social media. Comrade David Easley, whose voice you've heard on the show a few times, who's currently held at Toledo Correctional Institution, has in previous months been viciously assaulted by prison staff at the direction of TOCI Warden Harold May. This has been experienced also by a number of other inmates who have been isolated for torture and for other purposes, covert and overt retaliatory actions at the facility. They've been denied adequate medical care for speaking out against the cruel, inhumane treatment at this Ohio facility. More and more comrades are reporting this occurring throughout the ODRC and across the country for any who dare stand up and speak for themselves and the voiceless within the steel and concrete walls. This is a call to action to zap the phone of U.S. District Court in Toledo, Ohio, and demand that Comrade David Easley be granted a phone conference with Judge James R. Knepp II and the Attorney General, because Comrade Easley's lawyer of record has decided to go rogue by not filing a memorandum contra motion as his client requested, and now the state has presented a motion to dismiss his case in court. There is more details in our show notes. If you feel like writing to David, his address will be there as well. And for listeners who are interested, there is a fundraiser ongoing at the moment to cover lawyer fees as our good comrade Sean Swain attempts to argue to get his own release. So he's gotten the help of an outside lawyer, and that costs money. So give if you can. Check our show notes and also spread the word.
And we have one more final prisoner announcement. This is about the health of Giannis Dimitrakis, who's an anarchist bank robber, a
unaffiliated with any other group, who showed solidarity in the recent hunger strikes across Greece, and with a N-17 prisoner, Koufantinas. So this statement is from affiliates of the anarchist and autonomous radio station, 1431 AM in Thessaloniki, Greece. We're hoping to be able to conduct an interview with Giannis once he's healed up, and hopefully in time for the International Week of Solidarity with Anarchist Prisoners in August. Here's that statement. On May 24th, our comrade, a political prisoner, the anarchist Giannis Dimitrakis, was transported to the hospital of Lamia, seriously injured after the murderous attack he suffered at Damoku prison. Giannis barely survived the attack, and the blows he received caused multiple hematomas in the head, affecting basic functions of his brain. A necessary condition for the full recovery of this comrade is the complete and continuous monitoring of him in a specialized rehabilitation center by specialist doctors and therapists. In this crucial condition, the murderous bastards of the New Democracy government, M. Chrysokoidas and Sophia Nicolaou, and their subordinates decided on Thursday, June 3rd, to transfer Giannis back to Damoko's prison and even to solitary confinement cell, supposedly for his health. Transferring our comrade there, with his brain functions in immediate danger, is for us a secondary attempt to kill him. Damoko's prison does not meet the slightest conditions for the treatment and recovery of a prisoner in such a serious condition. As a solidarity movement in general, we are again determined not to leave our comrades' armor in their blood-stained hands. Nothing should be left unanswered. None of the people in charge of the ever-intensifying death policy that they unleash should be left out of our sights. Immediate transfer of our partner to a specialized rehabilitation center, hands down from political prisoners. Solidarity and strength to anarchist fighter Giannis Dimitrakis. So this is an opportunity to put some of this June 11th solidarity into action. If you know any government holdings or any embassies, if you want to do a banner drop and send it to anarchist Black Cross folks back in Greece or to 1431 AM, these would be welcome actions. Show solidarity how you can. Learn about Giannis's case and tell other people about him. These are some suggestions. The Final Straw is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, and here's a jingle from another project on CZN.
Are you tired of listening to Western experts talking how the world works?
Isn't it a portion of liberal analysis of the uprising makes you fall asleep?
Well, then check Elephant in the Room, an anarchist radio show from European Dresden, where we interview activists who are participating in struggles around the world.
Elephant in the Room is a proud member of Channel Zero Network. You can find our show on your favorite podcast platforms, CZN website, or somewhere on the internet.
From activists?
For activists.
And now some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain.
What you say, what you say, what you say, what? Oh, come like a boss!
There's a whole lot not going on right now. A whole lot more than you'd think. A few weeks ago, a Russian hacker group called DarkSide hacked into a pipeline and shut it down. We saw the fallout from that. Gas prices went crazy. Cars lined up for miles. Wall Street panicked. Just one hack of one pipeline and the sky fell. The world ended. Dogs and cats engaged in interspecies fornication. Then, as the pipeline started back up and a bunch of bozos in suits started the series of press conferences to convince us that everything was okay, it leaked out that the energy company paid the ransom. Yeah, they paid the ransom. And then the hackers gave them back control of their pipeline. I don't know about you, but this was the first time I've heard of this kind of cyber piracy. I mean, there was that virus thing a while back that affected a British hospital system or something. Remember that? I suppose that might qualify on the same thing. Maybe. But my point is, this kind of thing doesn't get much coverage. You'd think these events are rare. The truth is, this past year, corporations have paid hundreds of millions in ransom to hackers. hundreds of millions. That means these kinds of hacks are happening all the time, everywhere. And the corporations are just keeping it quiet. They don't want investors to know, or else that might upset the market. And they don't want the rest of us to know, because then we'd all quit our jobs, learn programming, and not have to work for a living. We'd all just hack the corporations and collect ransom. I remember years ago reading a book called Endgame by Derek Jensen. This was before he became a homophobic turd and started denouncing the political orientation of the only people who bought Derek Jensen books, which would be kind of like me denouncing savage cannibal maniacs. Anyway, in Endgame, Jensen was contemplating how hackers could bring the existing global economic order to a halt. He described how every aspect of the production and distribution process for every single product and component in the world is cataloged and directed from place to place electronically. So, if you could simply hack into those databases, you could misdirect every product and component to go to the wrong places, causing the entire system to grind to a halt. Nothing could be made. Nothing could be sold. Even more catastrophic, hackers could just as easily introduce viruses into those systems and effectively melt them down entirely. It could be done by just a handful of hackers. Even then, in the early 2000s, guys like Jensen were pointing out how we greatly underestimate the vulnerabilities of our cyber systems. Today, those systems are probably less secure, relatively speaking, than the bank's train car on the steam trains robbed by the James Gang in the 1800s. If Frank and Jesse James were alive today, they'd be computer hackers. Bonnie and Clyde wouldn't be toting machine guns, they'd be toting laptops. But what Jensen pointed out back then was, nobody was hacking the system in order to melt it down because, frankly, there was no money in it. As simply a practical matter, people who have that set of skills usually don't acquire them in order to liberate the world from the system of global capital, from the systems of mass production and mass destruction. They acquire those skills so they don't have to work 8 hours a day to buy cheese puffs and beer. But now there's a way to make money. In fact, there's a way to make hundreds of millions of dollars. The cartons of cigarettes at the grocery store are harder to steal than cyber ransom from major corporations. And so, now, I suspect, the Internet has become that slow-moving bank train that the James Gang intends to rob again and again. And just a side note here, but if banks didn't want their trains robbed, they wouldn't concentrate that much money into the train cars. So, now we get to the discussion of who is really behind these cyber train robberies. From what I read, the biggest hackers are a kind of outsourced subcontractor from the Russian government, a group that is ostensibly independent from the state, but operating in full knowledge of state authorities. This kind of relationship was invented by the United States when it funded proxy wars in Afghanistan and in Nicaragua, creating a new standard as to what was okay on the international scene. Now outsourcing the plausible, deniable private operatives is the norm. Hey, America. Now, I don't have a problem with the Russian state running hackers who collect ransom from billionaires. I don't care who's behind it. But if the Russian state is behind it, we can count on these activities not taking down the global system of capital, because Russia benefits from the existence of the global system. Russia doesn't want to topple it. Russia just wants to improve their place in its pecking order. So, what I'm saying is, we can't count on the Russian state and its proxies to crash the global system. It won't go that far. It's going to take real non-state actors to replicate what the Russians are doing if we want to truly rob the train. It's going to take folks who are not beneficiaries of the existing order. Then, it gets really exciting. Until then, I think I'm cheering for the Russian team. They might not be Robin Hood, but they're a lot closer than the corporate executives with oil pipelines.
This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain, an exile from Ohio at Buckingham Correctional in Dillon, Virginia. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain by addressing letters to Sean Swain, number 201-5638, Buckingham Correctional Center, P.O. Box 630, Dillon, Virginia, 23936. You can find his past writings, recordings of his audio segments, and updates on his case at seanswain.org, or now follow him on Twitter at @SwainRocks. Would you please introduce yourselves, maybe who you are, what projects you're working on, and what experience you have with anti-repression prisoner support work?
June 11.
My name is Cameron. I live in St. Louis. I've been doing prisoner support stuff for to varying degrees for the last 10 or so years, having, you know, letter writing night. Fundraising for commissary stuff, sending in newsletters to jails and prisons.
I'm Vera. This is the biggest anti-repression prisoner support project that I'm a part of, or the longest running one. But similar to Cameron, I've been doing some support work for prisoners for probably the last 9 or 10 years, and have just maintained pen pals with several different prisoners across the states. And currently in Southern Ontario, there are prisons across the region that are on hunger strike for different reasons, just especially in regards to the pandemic and how they've been treated. And so I've been plugging into some of the hunger strike support work here, but also still getting acquainted with how projects are done here in this new place that I live.
Okay, my name's Earthworm from Atlanta, and I work with the Atlanta Solidarity Fund and the Protester Jail Support Team and Cop Watch of East Atlanta. And we've got a lot of protester support experience because our friends have been getting arrested for years at different protests. So we turned it into something that has scaled way, way up, of course, particularly in the last year with the George Floyd uprising.
Well, you know me, my name is Jeremy Hammond. I was recently released from federal prison several months ago. And, I've been involved for most of my adult life. And since my release, I've just kind of been slowly getting my feet wet and seeing what my involvement would be most appropriate. And I'm also here with my brother, Jason Hammond. That's my voice right here. I'm his brother. And I'm a longtime supporter of Jeremy, but I'm also, of course, involved in on-the-ground protest-type-related movements. One group that I'm a volunteer for is the Chicago Community Bond Fund. It's a bond fund that I've been involved in prison abolition struggles, most notably the George Floyd Black Lives Matter uprising. Last year, we did a lot of work for political prisoners during these uprisings, too.
Can you tell us more about the role of your projects in uprising anti-repression and some of the prisoners you're supporting, or talk about examples of political coordination and action with other prisoners that might give the audience a sense of the agency of folks behind bars?
Well, in 2014, a group of us started supporting folks who got locked up during the Ferguson uprising, and it kind of came out of desire to not ignore, but actually just actively promote the reality that the folks that were participating were engaged in risky and creative and destructive actions like looting or shooting guns and arson. And we kept seeing a lot of people fall through the cracks in 2014, in terms of getting support from the quote unquote movement. And so we just really wanted to make sure that folks got some kind of support. And so a lot of the people that were participating weren't really a part of a movement per se. They weren't in an activist organization, or they weren't organizers. They were kind of articulating themselves outside of that. And so we just felt like that was really important to see and acknowledge, because, there were people have gone away for, are now in prison for, 5+ years, some people, because of what they did. And there's all sorts of sort of narratives by nonprofits and activists that the people who are doing the heavier stuff were hurting the movement or kind of a part of a conspiracy of outsiders or criminals. And it felt like that kind of narrative was just reproducing the same that caused this moment, this uprising, this sort of like demonization of people, like this sort of keeping people in their place, ignoring the fact that people have agency and ability to like refuse to be victimized by systems that want to kill them or hurt them. And I personally just felt like I was very frustrated to not see that narrative promoted or like accepted. That was kind of the big reason why I got involved in supporting folks. To go back to like nonprofit stuff, like a lot of those folks weren't really seeing like what was happening right in front of them. This was an uprising that was extremely combative against not just the police, but also private property and the authority of a lot of people who want to keep things the way they are. And people from all walks of life were, you know, just coming to this situation and like getting wrapped up in it and like getting arrested and like doing things that were dangerous and not really talked about in like a legible, easily palatable story. Yeah, it was just a very hard thing to watch. And having gone through my own like legal like issues through going through courts for years and being arrested a bunch of times and just like knowing how like that is to experience and how like grueling it is to like go from one continuance to another and just like not, and like I knew I had people who had my back and people who would come to my court dates, and I just wanted to like return that as well to other people.
Yeah, I can maybe just talk a little bit more about the specifics of the project that Cameron and I are a part of. As far as like the prisoners that we are supporting, they are just from a compilation or like a list that we compiled from just mailing letters to people who got arrested during the Ferguson uprising, people from all walks of life and in that neighborhood, and not necessarily people that we could say that we were like politically aligned with, because it might even be safe to say that all of the people that we are supporting when we started supporting them wouldn't necessarily have aligned themselves with any sort of politics. Yeah, we sent letters and just said basically if they were willing to, we would put them on this public list, which is the list on Anti-State, put their images out there and their mailing addresses and their and thereby making it easier for people across the country to support them. And so that list we've maintained, or someone has maintained over the years. And we had, I think, 11 people at one point, and now it's down to, oh gosh, like 5 or 6 maybe, because people have gotten out. Just specifically from that list of folks, there's 2 people that I spend a lot of time in communication with, and with them and their families, and have visited and everything. And one of them, actually, Cameron was alluding to this, but you know, people would get arrested in Ferguson for doing a lot of what a lot of people were doing, which was, you know, looting and destruction of property and everything. And one of the guys that I support was arrested for those things. And then because of priors, whenever he was sentenced, he actually got a sentence of 60 years. So he's going to be in for the rest of his life. So that's like a very long term. In some ways, that to me is like very mind blowing. And it's a very good example of the people that were acting in the streets weren't always people that we were familiar with their lifestyle or familiar with the risks that they were taking.
So we ran jail support for anybody that was arrested, and we're doing prisoner support for anybody who is stuck in jail because denied bail or because they're, you know, unfortunately sent to prison. So we've provided all sorts of support for arrested folks.
All right. Well, certainly my experience in prison, you have a wide variety of individuals who are locked up, many of which have become politicized in prison. And so they see someone who's locked up on a case like such as mine with support from political movements on the outside. You know, people know that I'm an anarchist and a prison abolitionist, right? And a lot of people are very curious about this, right? And because of all the experiences in their own lives having been repressed by the criminal justice system. As far as examples of coordination, you know, there's unfortunately, like prison, they want to bury you, right? They want to prevent you from communicating to the outside world, to receive information of what's going on in the outside world. And so the work that's being done on the outside, such as, you know, everything from books to prisoners, to support at people's court dates and stuff, to having, you know, noise demonstrations inside the jail, really gets people who are, you know, curious about what's going on. Like, and so, you know, for example, like I would regularly receive zines and newsletters from ABC and other organizations, right, which are very useful in discussing things that we would otherwise only have access to, like, say, for example, something on the news. Like, we would only receive information about what's going on with, like, the like George Floyd uprising, the Michael Brown uprising, based on what was in the news, right? But now we have additional materials to share and discuss as a focus of discussions, for example, newsletters from actual movement stuff itself. And so when people see, like, the jail demonstrations outside the jail, when people see that there's, you know, people attending each one of your courtrooms, that they know that there is kind of a camaraderie, a sense of loyalty and commitment to something, it kind of brings, like, prisoners together, that, you know, we're not just alone, that we're, there's a continuum of resistance, and each of our stories plays a part in that.
So this is Jason speaking right now. I could talk about my experiences with Chicago Community Bond Fund. Just a little back history. This is a bond fund that was organized in response to the uprisings in Chicago against the Chicago police scandal, the murder of Laquan McDonald. There were a large movement, which included a number of arrests to protest the cover-up and of the murder. And so we people had raised a good amount of money to bond out the resistors, the protesters. And in the wake of that, it basically coalesced into a movement of an organization that tried to address, you know, the problems of the prison system, the Cook County Jail, the mass incarceration project. It was an abolitionist project. So we started just working with the community and bonding out people's family, loved ones, friends, and all that, as basically as much as we could to try to empty the jail out. This was, I think, around like 2016. Fast forward to the George Floyd uprising. The organization had been long a supporter of the BLM movement. And when this had happened, the organization had definitely stepped up to, you know, do everything they possibly could within their organization to not just bond out, you know, the protesters and the activists, but of course, the larger community that was involved in, let's say, property distribution, looting, breaking property destruction. They cited clearly on that stance, which, in fact, BLM Chicago as well had made a stance to support people involved in the looting. So we, every day, we'd be out bonding people from Cook County Jail. Sometimes I personally would be with a list of like 10 people in the jail, just bonding as many people as we possibly could, as well as trying to amplify and elevate the struggles of other organizations working to change the system. Yeah, that's just one thing the Chicago Community Bond Fund had been, you know, doing in 2020. And we're still doing it. Yeah. And we're still doing it, you know. We also was a campaign to change the, you know, basically an end money bail type law in Illinois. It's said it's an end money bail, but of course felonies and a little bit less palatable type charges, like violent charges or domestic charges, are not available. But these are details in the bond bill. But it's still a pretty good bill, the Pretrial Fairness Act, passed in Illinois because of our grassroots shit. However, there are still plenty of other challenges beyond the fact about money. For example, where are the campaign was end money bail, right? However, there's all kinds of other like compounding details that would allow a person to get what they call a no bond. For example, if they have two charges, they could be bonded out for the first one, but for the second one, in light of the fact that they were already on bond, they could have just given what they call a no bond so that they're still in there no matter how expensive their bond is or depending on what kind of charge it is. So for that reason, there's still tons of people currently in Cook County Jail. And, you know, we are expecting the numbers to go down as the law rolls out, expecting to kind of like be fully implemented in 2 years. But we are going to still see a number of people still in the Cook County Jail system, even though they are pre-trial, just because of all kinds of other laws that would prevent someone from leaving, you know. A large part of this country do not want to see the changes that we are fighting for be implemented. And, you know, I mean, all you have to do is just kind of look at their rhetoric and what their actions are. They're pushing back in the legal sense as well. And yeah, there's a major political battle basically between the far right, the John Catanzara, FOP, CPD camp, as well as the state's attorney, Kim Fox, Lori Lightfoot. Kim Fox has been actually pretty vocal in support of the End Money Bail Project, the law. So, like, there's a political battle, of course, as well.
Have you seen your support work change over time? For instance, you know, the progression from supporting someone through their initial arrest and bonding out to serving a prison sentence or doing other like follow-up work with them, if that's not the case. Or if you were in prison, how did your needs change over time from the initial like court support and folks showing up and fundraising for lawyers during the initial phase to like maybe follow up?
Well, I mean, initially we, you know, found all these people's names from like media articles. Like there's a website in Missouri where you can just like find all the court records of cases. And so we just kind of like combed through all those and sent letters to them and stuff. And as folks started getting sentenced, some were incarcerated in prisons. Other people were like given time served because they'd been in jail the whole time and weren't bailed out. So then the focus shifted from doing like court support to like just letter writing and some amount of fundraising when we could. So like just trying to fundraise for putting money on their books, or like, you know, maybe some of us have steady work or whatever. So we, you know, give $10, $20 a month to one person each. At this point, if that's where it's at for the folks, at least for me, where for the folks that are still locked up. And a few folks have been released in the last couple of years. We kind of always try to check in with them when they're about to get released. Like if they need anything, like here's what we can offer. Like it's a pretty small group. We're not like a actual like organization, or like we just like kind of run on our own capacity, but we try to, you know, help people when they get released a little bit. And I've maintained communication with at least one person pretty steadily who's been released, and we're friends. And but yeah, basically it's like kind of, it's been so long. I mean, 2014 is so long ago, and a lot of these people, like maybe, you know, they were in prison and they got out, and there was never like an effort to convert somebody to like some political sway or like political ideology. It was always just sort of like you were a participant, and we would want the same if we were locked up. So because of that, like a lot of times there's still a connection, but also people like have their own lives and they've like move on, or they like have their struggles. And I don't know, I guess I bring that up because, yeah, just to like sort of talk about like the capacity that we have as individuals trying to do this, and how we're not a charity, we're not a nonprofit or like social workers. So we're kind of trying to meet people where they're at and like have like a more down to earth relationship. And if it leads to more of a friendship, then great. If it doesn't, that's not the point of it or whatever.
I would echo a lot of that. Honestly, like the progression, I guess, of what our support work looked like at times, I would even say was like a bit awkward and clunky, like without this baseline of, you know, we are anarchists or we are radicals, and therefore we acted during this uprising. I think it was a bit unclear for both the folks that were locked up and their support networks as to who we were. You know, we're not social workers. We're not like an activist organization with a bunch of money coming in. You know, we have a little website on No Blogs, and we're kind of, you know, as far as this group is made up of now, I think there's like two people left in St. Louis who are still there and still active in it, and the rest of us are all over. So it's rather like a disjointed and kind of a funny, awkward conversation to have at times, you know, where I'm talking to one of the guys that I support, his name is Alex, and I had to have like several conversations with Alex's mom to kind of like get her to understand who I was, and that I wasn't like someone who was going to help place her son in a job once he got out. I was just someone who was going to make sure that her son was looked after. And not forgotten about. And, you know, if something needed to happen where, you know, he needed his caseworker to be bothered about some piece of mail, or if he wasn't getting shoes or something, then I was the person that was going to call and do that. And those sorts of things. I think that we had to be willing to kind of have those awkward conversations with people. And I think that, you know, for the most part, that's been fine. You know, at worst, it's awkward, you know, but we have been able to raise money and get people, when they get released, we've been able to give them phones and, you know, clothing and help them feel cared for in small ways. And I think that that's a really important piece of what we do.
Earthworm, can you tell us about Atlanta?
I guess when we started doing jail support work, it was more on the fly in response to arrests happening. It was just kind of catch as catch can. You know, somebody would be in jail and they'd need $4,000 to go to a bail bondsman to cover their $40,000 bail, and we would need to come up with it just by calling all our friends and, you know, scrambling to put somebody's rent money up and hope that somebody could pay them back by the time rent's due. And we realized in doing that that we needed a more organized and we needed a bail fund. So in 2016, we started collecting money for that. And, you know, sometimes when people get arrested, it makes a lot of news and a bunch of donations roll in. And sometimes you're able to even set some aside and have that for the next set of arrests. And, of course, sometimes it's more expensive than the amount you bring in. So we sort of struggled along through a whole series of different protests. And then in the George Floyd uprising, we were fortunate enough that we already were established and we had a website and we had, you know, this long history of being able to bail out protesters. So we were sort of already a trusted group and we were able to be really central in that effort and got way more donations than we were used to, but of course also way more arrests than we were used to. But with the donations, we were able to cover a lot more of the protesters' needs. So, you know, whereas before the money had just been very strictly for bail and hiring lawyers, you know, we've been able to do things like pay everybody's fines and fees and pay for medical costs and pay for, you know, other incidental things like a babysitter if you need to go to court, other things we, you know, would never have been able to afford before. And the other thing that is a very blessed change is we no longer have a cap to the amount of bail that we're able to post, because before we had enough money, we didn't want to blow it all on one protester. So if you were in there on, you know, $40,000 bail or bond, we could only cover a portion of that, and then we would have to scramble to fundraise the rest of it. So in the early stages, even before arrests happen, when we hear about a protest getting set up, the arrest might happen, we get the jail support team together and start scheduling, you know, who's going to be available for the, you know, 36 hours after the protest if arrests go down. So we've got our phone people there's a physical cell phone because that's all you can call from jail, and they take turns carrying that, and they'll, you know, one phone person will bring it to the next person when their turn is over. We schedule people to do arrestee tracking, which is finding out who's been arrested, finding them in the jail system, and keeping track of them to figure out when they are able to be bailed out, and then getting them bailed out and getting people to meet them there at the jail when they're out. And then once they're out, that is when court support takes over. And that's everything from keeping track of when their court dates are and sending them reminders to, you know, finding the lawyers and helping, you know, getting people there to their court dates and whatever sort of support they need while their court case is going on. And then once their court case is over, there's follow-up. You know, hopefully they don't go to prison or anything, but there may be support to do as far as helping them if there's going to be a civil lawsuit, helping them find lawyers for that, or helping them with whatever kind of evidence gathering or whatever support they need with that. Of course, they may have fines and fees to pay, or like ankle monitor fees, and that's all stuff that fortunately now we're able to afford. Or unfortunately, sometimes people go to prison, and then it's time for prisoner support, which we do also to the people who are denied bail and they're sitting in jail waiting for their trial to happen. of which we've got about 8 in Atlanta. So that means writing them letters, and they also have the phone number, so the same phone people who are doing the like intake calls the night that people get arrested are also hearing from the long-term prisoners. And just figuring out what support they need. Ideally, everybody who's sitting in jail has their whole support crew of friends and family and whatever supporters. And those support crews can coordinate with each other and with the Solidarity Fund to make sure everybody's getting what they need. Failing that, the jail support team just needs to act as the support crew for each prisoner, meaning that the only number they're calling is the jail support phone, and the jail support phone people are communicating with the prisoner support people at large who aren't like the prisoner support for a particular individual, and just saying, you know, so-and-so wants this kind of books. Can anybody volunteer to send them that? Or, you know, so-and-so is not receiving medical attention and we need to get everybody we know to call the jail and pressure them to let him see a doctor, and so on like that.
Oh my gosh, it sounds like y'all really got that figured out.
Well, I think it's a process of figuring it out on an ongoing basis. I appreciate you saying that, but I definitely don't think anybody feels like we have it figured out.
This is Jeremy. So certainly the arrest and pretrial support work is very crucial. It's very different than, say, post-conviction, post-sentencing. First, I think we just need to listen to the particular circumstances and needs of each person and their charge, but also recognize that since we're talking about groups and waves of repression, all the circumstances are also linked. In particular, somebody who's facing charges often can't openly talk in detail about like what they're particularly being charged with. So I think it kind of does rely on support communities to kind of, it's a political battle because they want to like build support for the individual, but also like build support for the particular so-called crimes that they've been accused of, if it's like a direct action that they're currently in prison for. So the way the public narrative goes the way of in support of what the prosecution's characterization of the crimes are, right? Like if, say, some of the actions over the past couple of years and the uprisings involve various arsons and property destruction, like, well, I think it's important these groups doing support work, not just support the individual and whatever the particular like legal strategy is, like say they're innocent or whatever, but also support the actual crimes themselves. We have to legitimize the act itself to the public. And then, of course, post-conviction, you know, hopefully, I think it makes a difference the amount of time and in the whole negotiation process, the charges like the prosecutors are willing to offer up. It does make a difference if they believe that the person being prosecuted is in isolation, versus if they're part of like a movement, and the prosecutor's strategy is also different, and they might be more willing to make like better deals or make concessions that would be a better outcome for the individual. And then, of course, post-conviction, you know, post-sentencing, you want to give a voice to someone who's now freely able to speak. And then, of course, the other thing is, as the person's time draws to a conclusion and they're about to be released, the needs also change. You want to make sure that somebody has every opportunity to make it upon their release, especially like long-term prisoners, like their ease of adapting. And fortunately, I can say that like they've taken care of me throughout my entire bid, and I have nothing but respect and admiration for the various groups that came on in support of me. And because of that, I had a pretty easy transition when I was released. You know, people came and picked me up from the jail. People were bringing me stuff at the halfway house. You know, my brother and friends made sure that I had a place to stay. You know, so these type of things like help ease the transition, you know what I mean? Because otherwise the state would just kick you out and basically hope that you fail again. And so it's up to us to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Yeah. And that, but on that point, it, especially when a person's been inside for decades, like a decade is a long fucking time. But if someone's been in for 30 years, like the amount of change that's occurred during that period of time, the amount of loss of loved ones, like,
it's truly shocking, especially like the cultural changes, the changes in their city. You know, people might not, everything is technology, people definitely have difficulty adapting to how people apply for jobs and people secure housing and stuff like that is all different now.
So there have been thousands of people arrested during the George Floyd uprising last year, over 300 federal cases and innumerable state felony cases. So given your experience, what can we be doing now to prevent and prepare for those uprising defendants, some of them serving time in prison?
Cameron and Vera?
To me, it feels kind of inevitable. Part of it feels hard to prevent people from acting, or not that you're, this is not, that's not the question, but like prevent, like repression is, it feels hard because uprisings are often just sort of like, they're super spontaneous and people like who don't necessarily consider like surveillance or security culture like maybe some of us do, or like anarchists or radicals do, like are going to get caught up in like the repression. And I guess ideally it would be a matter of trying to like really push for people to like be aware of if like a surveillance camera can see you, or be aware of like the risk that you're taking, but also like in some ways having that kind of sort of awareness can actually kind of placate you. So it's sort of a hard balance to figure out how to like kind of prevent avoidable like repression, because yeah, people are going to do what they're going to do. And like I think at least having that baseline of that's what's going to happen is like where I start from.
I think it's very hard to know how to talk about what prevention looks like. We have our experience, and especially having gone through Ferguson, and especially like the repression support work post Ferguson, we can look at that and say, okay, we know how bad this can get, so you know, let's keep this from happening. But then, you know, how do you do that? Like, how do you like make those connections in the moment? I can remember a moment last summer during one of the demos, the George Floyd demos that happened. And I was hyper aware of everyone that didn't have their faces covered. And so I'm running around, you know, and I'm a white woman who's, you know, in my 30s. Running around telling people to cover their faces, and they feel invincible in the moment. You know, they feel like nothing's going to stop me. Like nothing, no one's stopping me right now. Like, what do I care? And here I am running around telling them all like, to cover their faces. And they're looking at me like, no, get away from me. This isn't your moment, you know? And in like some ways it's like, yeah, that's true. And like, what am I going to do? Am I going to stop you and say, look, I know how this goes, you know, I know how this ends, and start telling them, you know, the answer is no, I'm not going to do that. But I think that that is part of what we can do, you know, like show up to these things with just bandanas to hand out, you know. And as far as preparation, I don't know, I thought about that, but I think that the model of what this support group is doing, find a small group of people, and we're a small group of people that are just willing to say, okay, these 11 people, we're going to make sure they're taken care of. And I think if you can form groups like that and just kind of trust each other to do the bottom line for some of these people that are getting locked up, I think that that can be a really good start.
Number one thing, I think we need to be educating everybody that we can about not talking to police and doing other security culture measures to keep ourselves from going to jail in the first place. You know, as far as educating people about wearing masks and security cameras and just taking precautions about things that could get somebody in trouble, not talking about illegal things that somebody could get in trouble for, not posting sketchy stuff on social media, not talking to the cops or anybody who might talk to the cops. And when I say not talking to the cops, like not saying anything to the cops other than I'm going to remain silent, I want to see a lawyer, or am I being detained, am I free to go, or I don't consent to a search. And that is it as far as what anybody should say to police. So I think holding trainings and holding them for as many people as we can, particularly because we're getting lots of brand new people who aren't used to being protesters, is going to save us so many countless hours and misery in terms of people going to jail and potentially prison later on, because it's so heartbreaking when you hear about somebody didn't know that they shouldn't talk to the cops, or they didn't know that they had the right to not talk to cops, and they just, you know, threw away what power they had to protect themselves. And their kids. Or I guess you could say, conversely, when we hear about people who did get that training and did know to keep their mouth shut and were able to tell their friends to keep their mouth shut, that prevents them from going to jail, and that is a huge relief. You know, when we hear from people and they're like, oh, no, I didn't say anything to the cops, you think I'm crazy? That's just like a choir of angels singing to heaven.
So first off, as with everything, it's important that you think through your actions before you carry them out. And I think it's also important to look at kind of the history of cases and to see, like, how people got caught and the mistakes people have made, so that way we don't repeat the same mistakes, so that way we don't keep, like, this ongoing cycle of arrests and incarceration. We obviously want to reduce the numbers of people captured by the state.
This is Jason now. Yeah, so obviously don't get caught is the ongoing lessons that we're trying to learn. Secondly, we can't forget we have to keep the momentum up for people who are facing charges. We have to demand their charges be dropped in whatever form we can. You know, we could be writing letters, we could be doing petitions, we could be doing protests, we could be doing rallies, we could be doing letter writing parties, we could, you know, organize our own letter writing chapters, we could organize our own prisoner support chapters. So there's all kinds of things that we could be doing and are doing to kind of keep the momentum up. This is a pretty unique moment. We are still in the wake of one of the largest uprisings of many people's lives. And there is a lot of energy ready to be harvested to kind of push the abolition, you know, our work forward, as well as, you know, change the system. So, you know, the people who are arrested, you know, trying to, you know, fight the power, change the system, they really need to be supported if we agree with their goals. So let's just do everything we can to keep the momentum going. And, you know, people are exploring new ways of doing this.
Is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not an empire. I am a free man. number, you weren't a name, you want to be a unit. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. The law. When they hang my husband...